Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. And boys, feel like it's been a while since I've been able to say that. This is Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, and this is Wrestling Night in America for January 7th, 2024. And this is the place where we talk all the big shows in pro wrestling. So if you're a new listener or you've taken advantage of the Torch's VIP sale, first of all, welcome. Hope you enjoy all of the content that we have for you here at Pro Wrestling Torch. And secondly, this is the show where we talk about the big events in pro wrestling. And as of this past week, there wasn't any bigger event than New Japan's biggest event of the year, Wrestle Kingdom, followed up by New Year's Dash just a day later. So that's what we're going to focus tonight's show on. But if you want to participate and talk about some of the other things that happened this week, certainly big episodes of Raw and SmackDown as well. We'll touch on that a little later on. You can call us up, 515-605-9345. We're talking to you live here on pwtorchdailycast.com. You can also email us anytime at wnialivecast@gmail.com. If you see something happen on a show and want to email us and get our thoughts on it or get your thoughts out there, we'll read them on the next episode. So I have the emails open, so if you're listening live, you can certainly participate in that way tonight as well. So I want to bring on my co-host here to help me wade through New Japan and its big shows of the week. So welcome aboard PWTorch.com contributor Chris Lansdell. Chris, happy to have you along with me here tonight to talk New Japan.
Hey, Greg, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been a long-time listener, so being part of the show is a big bucket list check for me.
Oh, well, wonderful. It's great to have you on, your first time co-hosting. And what better event to have your first time co-hosting then. And I know it's something you cover for the Torch New Japan, so you're going to carry this for me because
okay.
I certainly keep up on what's going on, but I don't watch every event. And so I try to catch the big ones. So, you know, if I ask a silly question, please be kind
as
we go through this. But yeah, I mean, Wrestle Kingdom, I just didn't feel the buzz necessarily about this show that I have for past Wrestle Kingdoms. What did you think about the build to this event? And then what did you think just first overall, the event itself in terms of the quality of it?
I think we're on the same page there. The event, if you take this event in a vacuum and look at it as just another show and compare it with, you know, some PLE, some WWE or the AEW shows, it definitely holds up. But if you compare it with some Wrestle Kingdom of the past few years, it definitely falls short there. The title match right at the top of the card, I think, suffered from being pretty easy to figure out who was going to win that one. And the rest of the card did seem a little light. You know, the star power wasn't really there in the top matches. You had the dream match, second from the top, with Okada and Danielson, but you had Ospreay in a triple threat, which isn't necessarily the best place for him. There's no Ibushi this time around, of course. You had Shingo, who's probably one of the bigger names, a little ways down the card as well. The tag team title match didn't feel big. So overall, this one, it did feel a little less than in some ways. For really hardcore fans, though, the fact that Naito was in the main event with the chance to finally get his moment, which he'd been denied a few years prior, actually was a big drawing point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you, Sean Radican, and Rich Fan covered this on your Wrestle Kingdom Roundtable, so I will try to ask questions or bring up some points that you may not have already had the chance to talk about. I hope that
sure.
I won't make you repeat yourself too often here on this show. I do want to go specifically for Wrestle Kingdom match by match through this because it is New Japan's biggest event of the year, but just one more overarching thing from the two nights. We had Nick Nemeth come out with his brother Ryan at Wrestle Kingdom and came out as a fan, sat in the crowd, ended up brawling with David Finlay. And then at New Year's Dash, we had Matt Riddle on video challenging Hiroshi Tanahashi for his newly won television championship. So what do you make of these imports? You know, a lot of the draw, I think, of Wrestle Kingdom for foreign fans, the American fans, was seeing Bryan Danielson against Okada again, seeing Jon Moxley in action. And now here they bring in Riddle and Nick Nemeth. What do you make of both of those wrestlers making their New Japan debuts or re-debuts within this short time span.
Yeah, so New Japan's been trying to make inroads into the U.S. for a while. This started, I think, 4 or 5 years ago now, when Jericho went over and fought Omega, and then he's had a couple of matches at Wrestle Kingdom in the past couple of years. The use of a couple of recently released WWE guys is definitely there to bring buzz to the North American market and to get some disillusioned WWE eyes on the product. They do have a U.S. branch in New Japan strong, and a lot of the stuff we're going to see with Matt Riddle is making his debut, for example, at the Battle in the Valley pay-per-view, which is coming up next weekend, which is going to be main evented by Okada and Ospreay, which should not be missed by any wrestling fan. but it's definitely a move to attract some eyes from North America, some AEW fans, some people who liked Ziggler in WWE or wanted to see what Riddle was doing next. That's the goal here, is to get some new eyes on the product.
Yeah. All right, let's go through the Wrestle Kingdom card here. On the pre-show, we had the New Japan Ranbow, which was to find out the four wrestlers who would go on to New Year's Dash and fight for the King of Pro Wrestling Championship for 2024. It was Great Okan, Taiji Ishimori, Toru Yano, and Yo getting the victory in that. Ishimori ended up getting the win and the King of Pro Wrestling title at New Year's Dash. What do you make of this? It's been around for a couple of years now, the King of Pro Wrestling. Does that add something, do you think, to the palette of what New Japan is trying to offer fans?
I think actually it ties into our previous point about trying to attract new eyes. This is the comedy title. You do get some serious matches. Shingo Takagi held it for a little while last year and was having some really strong matches with the likes of Taichi. But for the most part, this is where you will find people like Toriano doing a lot, people who aren't really serious competitors. It adds some levity to the card. I don't like introducing new titles by and large, and when this one came out, I just sort of rolled my eyes at it. But it is unique. It does have its own sort of – it's 1 year at a time, and every year whoever holds it at the end of the year gets to sort of take home the belt, and then they make a new one. The Rambo itself is – It's just comedy. It's there mostly for comedy. Sometimes they build some feuds out of it, but you know, we had a couple of surprises in this one, and it really wasn't there to do anything.
You mentioned
but,
comedy. I think Yo advanced after straddling the top rope for half the battle royal. He's
well,
just sitting there.
He came out in a freak tracksuit to start with, and was just at one point he lost his shoes, then he lost his socks. Then he went up top and got crotched, and he just sort of laid there with his head on the turnbuckle and essentially took a nap for about 5 or 10 minutes of the match and ended up just by sheer happenstance being one of the final four.
Isn't that the dream, being able to take a nap during a battle royal and still advance? Living the lazy wrestler's dream, I think.
Work smarter, not harder, right?
Exactly. So the first match of the show was a title change where TJP and Francesco Akira defeated the Bullet Club War Dogs of Drilla Maloney and Clark Connors for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team Championship. I will say the one thing that I liked about this was Drilla Maloney and Clark Connors. They have a good look. I mean, it's a winning look, I think. It's a look that can make you stand out. And that's we know how important that is in pro wrestling. So right off the bat, new junior heavyweight tag team champions. You know, when I wrote about the G1 in my column in the Torch newsletter, I wrote about the Bullet Club War Dog portion of the Bullet Club faction. What do you make of that portion? Are they, you know, they've been champions, obviously. Has that been successful at integrating these wrestlers as part of the prestigious or at one time prestigious Bullet Club group?
I've been a bigger fan of it than a lot of people. I think what they've done is essentially redefine what Bullet Club is. David Finley has sort of recruited people who fit his image, where he's just straight ahead, smash mouth style, very violent, very aggressive, and he's not above cheating occasionally. It does kind of blur the lines between what they're doing and what House of Torture is doing as a faction, but the style that you see from, you know, Maloney and Connors, or from Gabe Kidd and Alex Coughlin, who I'm even bigger fans of, is really very similar to what Finley himself does. And it's a different look for Bullet Club, but I do think it fits and it works nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm interested to see what their 2024 looks like, because they could be big beneficiaries of some pushes this year. The next match was Hiroshi Tanahashi, another title change here, defeating Zack Sabre Jr. for the NWJP World Television Championship. In fact, I think this was the sort of debut of the championship. It was actually established back in October, so a recent championship. But Tanahashi gets the victory. The one thing that struck me about this match, and I think people looking at how Tanahashi has slowed down in the ring, how he has scaled back a lot of what he does in the ring, and you can see the injuries taking their toll on him from an in-ring standpoint, and you see him match up against Zack Sabre, and you say, okay, that makes a lot of sense. You know, Sabre's this is a ground game, right? So they can wrestle on the ground and they can make a good match that way. The one thing that struck me, they did have a ground-based game, Chris, but it was fast-paced. And I think sometimes we get lulled into this idea that, well, because it's more of a mat-based match, it's slower or it's not as fast-paced. And what struck me in watching this was just how – and it was a match that lasted less than 9 minutes – so they had reason to go a little bit of a quicker pace because they didn't need to stretch things out 15, 20 minutes. But I really, you know, I'm a fan of Zack Sabre Jr.'s style to begin with. And to see it kind of, it was almost like watching his usual matches at 1.5 or 2 times speed here, which was awesome. And I thought it was really compelling in that way.
There's a line from a Toby Keith song, and this is might be the first, last, and only time I ever quote a Toby Keith song, that says, "I'm not as good as I once was, but I'm as good once as I ever was." And I think that's what we saw with this match. Tanahashi is definitely slowing down, but these NJPW TV title matches have been 15-minute sprints, essentially. A perfect example of that is when Sabre defended against Mike's Speedball Bailey, who is incapable of wrestling slowly. And that was something else. I don't know how long Tanahashi is going to hold this title. I think this was more about pushing Zack Sabre Jr. up the card than anything else. And Tanahashi just adds prestige to any title he holds anyway. But yeah, it was good to see Tana being able to move at that speed and hold his own with the technical genius of Sabre. Those two have great chemistry anyway. So this was a fun little match, I thought.
Well, the next match was a match of two up-and-coming wrestlers, Yuya Uemura defeating Yota Tsuji by pinfall. I got to say, Uemura, maybe the best hair in wrestling at this point. I think that's definitely – he's in the conversation for that. I was in awe, really. And the other thing I was in awe about related to Uemura is he was so good at the fundamentals. And that's saying something, because the folks who come out of the New Japan Dojo, like Uemura, they are – as fundamentally sound as anyone coming out of any wrestling school in the world, probably. So to stand out in that way, to me, I think really speaks volumes about those fundamentals and those skills that he was able to display in this match. Now, I mentioned that both of these are young wrestlers looking to make their mark. They're in a singles match. They're not hidden in a tag match here at Wrestle Kingdom. So I think that is notable. But what's your outlook for the main event potential for both of these guys? I mean, do you see them as even? Do you see one of these guys having a brighter future at this point than the other?
So it's an excellent question, and I think this is a good time to talk about what a great point this is to get into New Japan Pro Wrestling. I know a lot of our listeners tonight aren't necessarily familiar with New Japan. There's a lot of change going on in that promotion right now, and these two guys, Tsuji and Uemura, are two of the next generation, along with Ren Narita and Shota Umino, who we're going to talk about shortly. Tsuji is probably the most ready to be in the main event right now. He has the charisma. He has a very easy magnetism about him. His grin is so infectious that it just makes you want to watch him, either because he's happy or because you want someone to punch the grin off his face. He's also more dynamic in the ring. He's not as technically sound as Uemura is, but very few people are. The most complete package, though, is probably Shota Umino, who we'll talk about, as I said, in a little bit. But of these two, I think Tsuji is definitely the one with the best main event potential. I do think Uemura will get there.
Yeah. I'm really excited. You mentioned it is a time of change in New Japan. I mean, you look at some of the top stars in the company. Okada, his future is still up in the air in terms of free agency and the like. You've got Tanahashi, who we mentioned. His best days are behind him. You've got even Naito, who became IWGP champion on this show, closer to the end of his career than the beginning. And these are three guys who've really carried this promotion for the last several years. So
yeah.
To see New Japan acknowledge that and have these young guys in positions where you can kind of see them slowly working their way up the ladder to the point where it's not a surprise. It's not like you're throwing someone into the fire who's not prepared and not ready. These guys are working years to get to that point where they're going to be ready to take over for some of those main event stars.
So the New Japan Dojo system is actually full right now. They're not taking any new people. They just sent two people on excursion.
I just sent my application yesterday, Chris. Disappointing news for me.
Oh, man, you know, I know it's actually a really easy commute from you as well, right? Like there's that train that goes direct from Florida. You're in Florida, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Yeah, nice and easy trip. But the New Japan Dojo system is so good at getting people ready to just wrestle matches, and then it's on them to come up with a character from there. And for those of you who don't know how it works, you start in the dojo doing basic moves over and over and over again until you have them down pat. Then they start putting you on preliminary matches on New Japan cards where you're only allowed to use moves that you've mastered and you're only allowed to use the Boston Crab as a finisher. And you never win except against other young lions, which is what they call the dojo students. Eventually you learn enough and you go off on excursion to another promotion. All of the four guys that were on the New Japan, or on Wrestle Kingdom card that are the young guns, so you've got Uemura and Tsuji, Umino and Narita, they have come back from excursion and they are now ready to be main event players. Tsuji's already had a world title shot. Umino's not far off. And then the other two are a little ways behind. But the system is great for getting people into a position to succeed or fail on their own merits. And so far, all four of these guys are definitely succeeding.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's going to be fun to track them, certainly for 2024, but even further into the future there. The next match was House of Torture of Evil and Ren Narita defeating Shota Umino and Kaito Kiyomiya in a tag match. This was your House of Torture special. There was interference, but there was not as much as I thought there would be. Of course, the match was about 7 minutes in length, so you only had a limited time for the interference. But this is, you know, we talk about the young lions, we talk about the guys who are going to be main eventers in the future in New Japan, and Ren Narita and Shota Umino. One of my favorite parts of the G1 2023 was these two going at it.
Yeah.
You know, they went to a no contest in the block matches. Then they seemed to be on opposite sides of every tag match that they were involved in, so they were always getting into it, pushing and shoving after the bell. I mean, it was really fun to see. Was kind of hoping that they would have a singles match here at Wrestle Kingdom, but, you know, saving it for down the line, I get it. But that seems like a match that New Japan is building for, like, 2-3 years down the line as an IWGP Championship match, main event type feud.
It 100% will be. These two are main event stars of the future. Umino, perhaps more so than anyone. He is the next Okada or the next Tanahashi. The way that they have been keeping these two apart, though. So, yes, they had that G1 feud. They also teamed together for World Tag League. And then at the end of World Tag League, Narita turned on Umino and joined House of Torture. And since then, they've been having tag matches, multi-person tag matches against each other. But they haven't really squared off until recently. Narita's always found a way to escape and then attack Umino from behind and get the win through cheating. The last couple of matches they've had against each other, they've actually had some physicality, and it's getting more and more each time. I do expect them to have that singles match, and it's going to be big when it does happen. I wouldn't be surprised if it main events whatever show it's on. But they're keeping them apart, and I think they didn't want to put it here because they wanted to let Tsuji and Uemura have their moment.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, you don't want to have that overshadowed. And, you know, it's like the old adage, there are only so many main event spots, right? There are only so many spots for the spotlight for guys who are up and coming. And if you throw too many of them in there and try to give too many of them the spotlight, then nobody gets the spotlight. So certainly there's an argument for that as well. So let's take a break here from going over Wrestle Kingdom, just kind of reintroduce ourselves for those just joining us. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, being joined this week by PWTorch.com contributor Chris Lansdell. And we are talking New Japan and Wrestle Kingdom here on Wrestling Night in America, where we are each and every Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, on PWTorchDailyCast.com. So 515-605-9345 is the number to call if you'd like to comment on anything we're talking about or anything else happening in the wrestling world. So we do have a couple people on hold, so let's go to the first one. It is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, good to hear from you again. What's your first question for us tonight?
My first question is, what's your bold prediction for 2024 for wrestling?
Oh, gosh, I think you ask this every year, Ryan, and I always try to squirm out of it because I am not a bold predictor. I feel like, okay, it's got to be, okay, I'm going to say this, I don't even really believe this, but I know this is kind of out there in the ether as part of a discussion, but Monday Night Raw goes on Warner Brothers TV. That's, you know, that's the big discussion point right now is where does Raw end up? SmackDown is going to USA in 2025, and Raw's TV deal is going to close at some point in 2024. AEW, of course, is negotiating in 2024 for where their shows are going to end up as well. But if I had to make a bold prediction, I guess it would be a bold prediction that's grounded in some sort of reality, because I could say anything crazy and you know, off the wall, but I'm going to root it in some sort of reality, Chris, and I'm going to say WWE ends up on TNT, TBS, one of the Warner Brothers Discovery channels. Chris, I got to have your bold prediction for 2024.
Okay. I'm going to one-up you. Some point in 2024, although I don't expect a full opening, we will see a WWE talent and an AEW talent in the same match.
Oh. Worlds colliding. I like it.
Yeah. Forbidden Window, maybe.
Yes. Yeah, I think it would be even bigger than a Forbidden Door. It would be, what would be bigger than a door, but something forbidden. I was going to say black hole, but that's probably too big. But something smaller, bigger than a door, an opening bigger than a door, but smaller than a black hole. I'm sure there's some sort of wormhole, maybe. I don't know. I'm getting a little too off topic here. But, yes, that is a great one. I that wouldn't have even been on my radar, but that is really interesting. We've seen WWE crossover with TNA, with Mickey James being in the Royal Rumble last year. We've seen AEW work with almost any company under the sun. So, you know, while they're still competing for TV deals, I'm not sure, but maybe once all that gets ironed out, we could see something. That's really interesting. You've got the wheels turning in my head now about who that could be. So kudos, Chris, on that one. Ryan, your second question for us tonight.
Okay, second question is on Impact TV. You think this groundbreaking signing is going to be for next week that Scott D'Amore has been pushing? Do you think it could be Ronda Rousey or could it be somebody else?
Yeah, I think Scott D'Amore, like you said, is plugging a groundbreaking signing for TNA. And they've got a hard-to-kill pay-per-view coming up this month. WWE's releases, as we saw with Nick Nemeth, we saw with Matt Riddle, we've seen with some others. It's the timing is a little too coincidental to not be one of those wrestlers. So I don't know if it's going to be Mustafa Ali. I don't know. It's just hard to look out at the landscape of free agents right now. And, you know, I think Alexander Hammerstone is out there from MLW. I don't know if that's really groundbreaking necessarily, though. But, yeah, Chris, I mean, TNA is touting this. It's a groundbreaking signing, so that could mean a couple different things, I guess. What's your take on who that could be?
I had seen a couple of people, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, suggesting MJF. That would be hilarious.
Can you imagine?
The internet would blow up. I don't think any of the WWE releasees are big enough. I mean, Mansoor and Mace Madden are probably a given to go to Impact, but I don't think that's groundbreaking. Goldberg's out there, that's a possibility. The only other thing I could see is somebody from the world of UFC or from Japan. So UFC, maybe John Jones or what's the guy's name that did some commentary with WWE? It's completely gone.
Daniel Cormier?
Yeah, that's the one. He's a big wrestling fan. Nothing else comes to mind.
I think the wording, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but the wording of groundbreaking, right? That to me goes beyond just a normal free agent who's out there. It's,
yeah.
And I think that's where you kind of plucking from the world of MMA maybe onto something there, that it's more than just a normal, even a big pro wrestling free agent. Maybe it's something even more than that. Or, you know, possibly even a non-wrestler. I don't know. But, yeah, the word groundbreaking I'm kind of stuck on. I think that's interesting. I'm not sure if that was purposeful or not on that.
Kevin
but we'll see. Oh, gosh.
But I think Ryan might have to be
on. Yeah, for a guy who is notoriously allergic to the limelight and never likes to have his face on TV or anywhere, like, I don't know how you would introduce that. I don't think he's going to come out and wave to the crowd or anything like that. So, but, yeah, boy. Ryan, your third and final question for us tonight.
Final question's on the Gable Stevenson dark match. Fans talking about him getting arrested years ago. Do you think that's going to hurt his chances of making the main roster?
I don't think the arrest is going to hurt his chances of making the main roster. I just think the general lack of acceptance of fans for his in-ring style. I know he had that big match that was that did not get over very well with the fans against Baron Corbin. Part of that was people finding out about his past, but part of it was he just was not in the ring as advanced as you would expect someone who spent as much time training as him and someone who comes from a wrestling background already. I think he's unfairly compared a lot to Kurt Angle, but, you know, Kurt Angle was a special case. Yes, he was an amateur wrestler like Gable Stevenson, but he was just a once-in-a-generation in terms of being able to pick up the nuances of professional wrestling, and to compare anyone to Kurt Angle I think is unfair to that person. So I think it was more of a combination of those two things than any kind of sordid background of Gable Stevenson himself. So, you know, I think there is a ways to go with him, Chris. I think WWE would love for him to be successful because of his amateur wrestling background and the credentials from quote-unquote real wrestling that he brings to sports entertainment. But just based on his last match and forgetting all of his background, which is problematic in and of itself, just focusing on the wrestling, he's got a long way to go.
It's a tricky one. As much as I wish that sort of a background was a disqualifying factor, we know it isn't. There's a reason that people call McDonough JD. Don't Google me, right? Having said that, I'm getting serious Mark Henry vibes from Gable Stevenson, because when he first came along, they had no idea what to do with him, and he was awful.
Yeah.
And it took the Nation of Domination to make him anything, and then it took him pretending to retire to make him into a main eventer. So they threw a 10-year contract at him. They haven't done that with Stevenson. They may just cut ties. They might just try until his contract is up and then send him packing. His brother is way better than he is.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of wrestling, yes. In terms of personality, I think Damon Kemp is – there's still a long way to go in that regard and promos and things like that. But I think that just speaks to how far behind Gable Stevenson is. So – I think we're a long way from having a conversation about Gable Stevenson as anything of significant value to WWE in the ring. So, Ryan, thank you for your phone call this evening, and look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Hopefully that J.D. McDonough story isn't true because I just looked that up. So thanks for bringing that to my attention.
Yeah, of course.
No problem.
All right, back to Wrestle Kingdom here, Chris. We have the next match on the card, which was Tama Tonga defeating Shingo Takagi to win the Never Openweight Championship. This is a guy who, in terms of Tama Tonga, he says he's leaving New Japan this month. And I looked back because I was like, I feel like his contract is up every 3 months. I feel like there's always a conversation about that. And so I went online and I looked, and he had re-signed, I think, in 2022, early in 2022. And then there were reports that he had re-signed as recently as October of this past year. So if he's leaving New Japan, did he sign just a short-term extension, or is he breaking it? I mean, or was that reporting incorrect? So I'm trying to figure out how he's leaving. And we've seen guys who've claimed, quote-unquote, they're leaving, and it was all just a storyline. So I'm not really sure. I don't know what the deal is with Tama Tonga. All I know is he wins the Never Openweight Championship here from Takagi in a match that, you know, quite frankly, I thought had a very G1 feel to it. And that is a compliment, because I'm someone who watches every show of the G1, every match of the G1, even the inconsequential tags that happen before the big matches. And to me, this had the feel of a G1 match. I mean, it was aggressive. It was hard-hitting. It felt it had a lot of energy to it, that kind of manic energy where these guys were working their butts off to try to win it.
Yeah, and that's been the sort of MO for Shingo's matches for this title and for Tama Tonga's, for that matter. I think initially I underrated this match when I first watched it, and on second viewing it definitely improved. It's just another hard-hitting classic between these two, and they have great chemistry. As for Tama Tonga's contract, I need to rewatch exactly what he said, because it's entirely possible he just goes to the LA Dojo for a bit and works for the strong side of the promotion. I believe his family is based in California, and of course the LA Dojo is in that area. Maybe he's going to see out his contract working there. WWE was heavily interested in him and both his brothers, if I remember correctly, being Hikuleo and Tongaloa. And we haven't heard anything about either of those guys leaving. So I think he would be able to go to WWE if he wanted to. He'd probably be able to go to AEW simply because he would be able to go to WWE. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think he wants to be closer to his family. That's what he said in the press release or the interview. I don't remember which it was. And the LA Dojo would allow him to do that.
It was at this point after this match that Ryan and Nick Nemeth came out to sit in the crowd. I did like how they brought them out, but they didn't get involved in the very next match. Because we see that a lot with WWE and AEW. When you bring somebody out, they just coincidentally get involved in the very next match. But a couple matches went by, and you almost forgot about them, and then they got involved with Finlay after that match. But next match on the card was the Guerrillas of Destiny, ELP and Hikuleo, in a winner-take-all match for the IWGP Tag Team Championship and the Strong Openweight Tag Team Championship, defeating Bishamon of Hirooki Goto and Yoshihashi, who were the IWGP Tag Team Champions at the time. So they pick up the victory there. Good match. Don't have all that much to say about this, I guess, other than, Hikuleo coming along. He's got that body where he's just so long and lanky, and he's got muscle to him. The nice thing is he's very coordinated. Like you worry about guys who are that big being a little uncoordinated, but he doesn't seem to have that problem.
He's got a lot better too over the past few years. I'm not sure who he's working with. I would hope it's Lance Archer, who is one of the most coordinated big men I've seen. But he's definitely got better. I do want to touch back to bringing out the Nemeth brothers before this match. It's actually an extra layer of smart, because they brought him out before the tag team match. So you could easily see a world where, okay, they're going to get involved as a tag team, and that's going to be what they do to start with. But then they let us forget them before Finlay got into Nick's face. So, I thought that was a really smart way to go. ELP is an interesting one for me. He is a little bit older than he looks, and I'm not sure how long he wants to continue wrestling, but he has an amazing mind for wrestling, and I think he will be an excellent trainer and coach when he decides he's done with the in-ring stuff, which could see him moving back to the U.S. either for New Japan or with another company. So I think he's by taking this match here, it's definitely an investment by New Japan in him as a wrestler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He's always impressive when I see him, so always like to see his matches, and such a good tag team wrestler as well.
Yeah.
Next up, we have
if you get a chance to watch the World Tag League final between these two teams, you really should. Mm-hmm. It's a 40-minute classic, and
this match
was nowhere near as good.
It was good. Not
the storyline from the final played into the finish of this match as well. So long-term storytelling over the course of two events close to each other like that is definitely worth seeing it.
Well, the next match we had for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship, another title changes hands here. El Desperado defeating Hiromu Takahashi for that championship. It feels like, and it's felt like this for a while, they have a good junior division, but it just feels like it's Hiromu Takahashi and then everybody else, like a level below. And maybe it's because every time I'm watching, Hiromu is involved in the title picture, so maybe it's just the events that I'm picking and choosing to watch. But is he, for someone who watches a lot more than I do, is he as head and shoulders above so much of the rest of the division as I perceive it from the times that I watch?
In a word, yes. The only times he hasn't really been involved in the title picture is when he's been injured. He did not win Best of the Super Juniors this year, and I think that was the first time in 4 years he didn't win. He's won it some ridiculous number of times. I can't remember off the top of my head. He's almost always at the top of the card, and there's a strong belief that this is him moving up to the heavyweight division now.
Interesting. Yeah, and I say that not as a complaint, because he is really good, and he's really entertaining, and it's so fun to see him come out with, I think it's him, he comes out with these jackets that are just so elaborate, WrestleMania-type style wardrobe, and it's not to the point where I'm saying like the LOL Cena wins type memes, about John Cena always being on top and always winning, but it's just something that I've noticed. And like, I totally understand because he is really good and he is really entertaining. So I understand why he's booked the way he is. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't being unfair to some of the rest of the division.
It's a very, very strong and deep division, and I think if they take Hiromu out of it, it gives the likes of Desperado, Master Wato, Sho and Yo a chance to really shine in this division. And Hiromu is just, he's such a chameleon. He can basically wrestle with anyone, any style. He can go fast, he can do mat, he can do power. So, yeah, I think he's going to be an asset to the company, even in the heavyweight division.
So the next match was an interesting one. It was Dave Finley defeating Will Ospreay and Jon Moxley in a three-way match for the inaugural IWGP Global Heavyweight Championship. And so you had, again, Finley and Nemeth brawling after the match. You had Finley and Will Ospreay, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, after New Year's Dash, making a cage match for February 11th. And so my question that I had after this match, where Finley beats the likes of Ospreay and Moxley, who are arguably the two of the top pushed wrestlers in two separate companies, the number two and the number three biggest companies in the world, and David Finley beats them here in this match, was this the star-making performance that Finley needed here?
That's a great question. I don't think this is the end of that star-making process. I think it's a step on that path, but he didn't pin Ospreay, or did he?
Yeah.
I don't remember. I have to look now. But it's a three-way, right? And
yeah.
he did put on a good performance, but yeah, he did pin on a sprain. My bad. I think he needs that one-on-one victory over one of these two guys or somebody just as big without Bullet Club interference. He's got a lot going for him. He's got the lineage. He's got the dislikability that makes you want to see somebody just punch that smug look off his face. He's got Gato behind him, who's really good at generating heat. But I haven't seen the star-making moment yet. I do believe he's capable of it. I do believe it's coming. I just don't think we've seen it yet.
So Will Ospreay said that his last match in New Japan, remember he signed with AEW, his last match is going to be February 11th, which is New Beginning in Osaka at the Edion Arena, and it's going to be a cage match against Finlay. So the idea that Ospreay is plugging this as his last match, the traditional way that it happens is guys lose on their way out. Ospreay lost in this three-way, as you noted. Is it possible that Finlay beats Ospreay again in the cage, or is this set up with Nick Nemeth a way to, you know, have Nemeth cost Finlay the cage match and move away from Ospreay and have Finlay then feud with Nemeth? So I think that, you know, in terms of star-making performances, I had wrote that question before I learned of the match with Ospreay in the cage. So, I mean, I think that has the potential, if they really wanted to be Finlay's real star-making performance. I don't know that I've ever seen a New Japan cage match. I mean, it's just not something that they do as far as stipulations go. So that has the potential to be a really memorable match for Finlay and that star-making match for him, possibly.
It's going to be huge. It's the first New Japan cage match in 20-ish years and the first one ever with fans in attendance. So that tells you right there, you know. In terms of they don't do a lot of interference angles from people not involved in factions. I can't see Nemeth getting involved. I think you're spot on, though. This will be Finlay pinning Ospreay in the middle of the ring with the other eight people in the match incapacitated or out cold. It's going to be a bloodbath. If you watch New Year Dash, which is free on New Japan World for anyone who wants to see it, the segment with these two factions facing off, Bullet Club and United Empire, is one of the most interesting brawls that didn't actually go anywhere that I can remember seeing in New Japan. It's so unlike them to do anything like this, but it works so well. And I really want to see how this match unfolds, because a New Japan cage match with 10 people in it, the mind boggles.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something I noticed watching New Year's Dash, is that that brawl, both before and after the match, actually. The semi-main event was Kazuchika Okada over Bryan Danielson. Singles match, no title on the line, nothing at stake, just Okada trying to get his win back. Where do you rank this? I mean, this was inherent when this match was made that there were going to be comparisons from this match to their Forbidden Door match that they had in AEW this summer. How would you rank them? Was this better, or was this a notch below what they did at Forbidden Door?
Well, I was in attendance for Forbidden Door. I actually called into the show that night. And I'm going to be biased as a result. I do think the first match was better.
Okay.
The goosebumps at Final Countdown hitting will never be replaced in my memory, let me put it that way. However, there's a long distance between the first match was better and this match was bad, because this match was not bad. This match was phenomenal.
Of course.
But it just didn't quite reach the lofty heights of the first one. For me, the thing that hurt it most was they didn't have that as much of the story beats as I wanted. There was not enough of Okada selling the arm later in the match. But that's a minor gripe that most wrestlers wouldn't be able to pull off anyway. But I do hold these two to a higher standard. Even so, incredible match.
Yeah, the story seemed to be Danielson working the arm of Okada as sort of, I don't know if it was a receipt for the injury that Danielson suffered in the match or whatever. But and then, you know, the eye coming into play as well. So certainly story to it, just not of the level. And And I think there's always that aspect of the first time, you know, that yeah. first time and the feeling that you're getting as a viewer watching two generational talents lock up for the first time. It's just a feeling that cannot be replicated in a second match between the two.
No, I think the fact that it was in Japan and the look on Danielson's face when he came out mm-hmm. actually added a layer of depth that we didn't have at Forbidden Door. Okada's stoic face for the entrance at Forbidden Door didn't really add another level like Danielson's excitement at being in the Tokyo Dome would have done. The last mm-hmm. time these two fought in New Japan, last time Danielson fought in New Japan was in 2004 when he was tagging with Curry Man for the Junior Heavyweight Tag Championships. So that tells you something right there, right? But no, I agree with you that it wasn't the first time ever. But I do think it still had that important feeling to it. And anytime uh-huh. these two lock up, it's going to be an absolute classic.
The main event, Tetsuya Naito defeating Sonata to become the IWGP champion, World Heavyweight Champion. Do you remember a main event title match at a show the level of Wrestle Kingdom for New Japan where the result was so locked down as it seemed that this one was?
No. The only thing that comes close was when Tanahashi beat Omega for the world title because we knew Omega wasn't staying in Japan. But even so, this going in, when Sean Radican and I did our preview, we both said if Naito does not win and get his LIJ roll call, Japanese people don't riot. There might have been a riot. The reaction when that three count hit and the reaction to the roll call when he got to do it, there was a genius bit of booking him before that, which we can talk about in a second. But if you listen to that crowd reaction that Naito got, I don't know how they could have done anything different. That said, there were some near falls there for Sonata, and the way they built the match, I did actually believe at times that they might do the unthinkable.
Yeah, I never got that feeling. So
okay,
and I like, and I've said this over and over again on this show when I've talked about New Japan, is I like Sonata. I really do. I like the style, the look change that he made in 2023. I thought that was a step up from the look that he had of the frosted tips and all that, you know, the hair and everything. I thought this was a much more presentable version of Sonata, a much more main event championship worthy look of Sonata. But, you know, I'll admit that, I'm not going out on a limb here, that his title reign was a disappointment. I guess my next question is, was his title reign such a disappointment that this is the last we see of him at this level for a long time? Maybe ever. I know that he challenged Naito again after New Year's Dash. I don't think even if that match happens that anybody thinks that Sonata is going to win the belt back. You know, I guess I would compare it to Evil. When Evil was champion, I think it was during the pandemic, and that was a title reign that was pretty critically panned. And, you know, Evil has still meant something. You know, he hasn't been relegated to the dregs of New Japan or anything like that. But I do wonder if, like, this was Sonata's chance to prove that he belonged at this level, and unfortunately it didn't seem to work out.
I don't think it's the last we'll see of Sonata, and my main reason for that is what happened after the match. When Evil tried to interrupt the roll call, and the person who saved Naito was Sonata, yeah. And he got the biggest reaction of his recent time from doing that, and then Naito put him over huge to the point that Sonata was crying as he walked back up the ramp. I think that was done intentionally to give Sonata a moment as well, because he needed it. His title reign was so bad that his T-shirt for the title reign said, "I am the seventh champ" on it, because if he didn't have that shirt, nobody would know. That's
yeah.
how bad it is. I hear what you're saying about making him look more presentable with the look change. I do also think it stripped away everything different about him, though. It just made him look like a generic Japanese wrestler. He looked like Antonio Inoki had shrunk down a bit. And it took away everything that made him cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's understandable. I get that, too. But, yeah, I guess I don't think it had an effect on his title reign. Either way, whether he had stayed with his previous style, obviously the change in style didn't help. So that's, unfortunate, but we'll see where New Japan goes with Sonata from here. I do want to talk about some of the key points of New Year's Dash here in just a moment. We won't go through every match on the card, but I do want to hit the mailbag here first. WNIALivecast@gmail.com is where you can send your emails. So I want to go to our first email of the night. This is from Azan. He says, Happy New Year, Greg and Chris. Number one, what is your take on Matt Riddle joining New Japan and how his baggage impacts New Japan, especially after last night's MLW show where he and Matt Stryker were portrayed in a negative light? Well, they were kind of portrayed in the negative light because they had it coming. I don't think it was – I think it was a pretty well established on social media. I didn't see it. I did see the clip of Matt Stryker sort of hand-waving away the accusations that have been made against Matt Riddle in the past. And Stryker himself defended it last night, and then he went on social media today and said he was wrong and should not have made those comments. So he's done a 180 from what he said yesterday. I know we talked about Riddle a little bit before. Do you think, New Japan has taken guys before with baggage, so I guess, and every company has. Look, I mean, that's the fact, Any company that is out there doing business right now has, at one time or another, signed wrestlers who have a history that is less than pristine. So,
yeah.
I to that end, I'm not saying that's right, but it's just, I don't know if we can look at New Japan in this specific instance and say what kind of negative effect could it have, because I just think I don't really know what negative effect it will have, if any, just because I think fans have been conditioned that wrestlers are not always pure of heart, and there are going to be companies that sign wrestlers that have baggage, and maybe Riddles are above and beyond the baggage that we've seen before in some people's minds. But do you think it's going to have any tangible effect on New Japan? Do you think they're going to have a severe backlash either at the shows or on social media for this?
Not at the shows. Social media, yes. Japan is a strange place when it comes to this sort of thing. You had the likes of Michael Elgin, who had a bunch of accusations against him. But it wasn't until he stole protein powder from a store in Japan that he basically got removed from all shows. I don't think New Japan is careless enough to bring Matt Riddle in without doing a background check, without knowing what they were getting into. And as much as Tanahashi said on New Year Dash, which I'm still laughing at, I don't know who that guy is. I'll have to do some research. I'm pretty sure he knows who Matt Riddle is. And I'm pretty sure before they agreed to this contract and these matches that they knew what they were getting into. Japanese fans aren't the type to bring this up. You're not going to hear chants or anything like that. You might hear boos because he's against Tanahashi, but not because of who he is as a person. But the social media backlash is already going, and it'll continue.
Isn't that the biggest insult you can hurl at a fellow wrestler is, I don't know who you are. We know what the egos of wrestlers are like, and that would be just strikes right to the core of them.
Definitely. Yeah. I don't know who that guy is. I'll have to do some research. I'm just like, ooh.
The second question that Azan has, how do you feel about NXT working with Japanese companies with Charlie Dempsey having a world championship match with All Japan this past week?
Yep.
Yeah, that was interesting. And I know, you have a beat on the Japanese scene a lot better than I do. So, maybe you can speak on this a little better, but we've seen AEW and Impact/TNA both have a relationship with New Japan. There's talk out there that WWE and Triple H would like to have a relationship with New Japan at some point, and perhaps, you know, this relationship with All Japan is a way for them to sort of dip their toe in the water. What's your take on it? I mean, you're the one, after all, who made the bold prediction of WWE and AEW working together, so I guess it can't be that much of a surprise that WWE is working with an All Japan-level company.
This is actually why. So there was a bit of news a little while ago that all of the big promotions in Japan are now working together on a number of things, and that we were going to see some supercards with all of the Japanese promotions coming together in the near future. So with that being the case, and WWE clearly willing to start sending people over to Japan, we had Nakamura going to face off against Muto. Now we've got Charlie Dempsey over there. I think there's a better than slim chance that we see somebody from WWE standing across the ring from somebody from AEW, and it probably will slip under people's radars until they realize what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. It's going to be interesting to watch. I mean, 2024 from that perspective of working together is going to be interesting. The third and final question Azan had for us: what do you think about AEW putting fresh faces in the main event level off the bat in 2024, such as Wheeler Yuta, Hook, Daniel Garcia, and Swerve Strickland? That is from Azan in St. Louis. Azan, thank you for the email. So I think part of it is you had Moxley in Japan. You had Bryan Danielson in Japan. But is this something we can extrapolate out for AEW from 2024 that maybe Tony Khan's New Year's resolution is to establish more guys at the main event level, new guys, as opposed to the same old or just teasing guys in the main event? Do you think this is anything to read into early here in 2024?
He has to do this. His last attempt at the Four Pillars was, what, a 50% success rate? MJF is an unmitigated success. Darby Allin, I think you can put on that same level. Sammy Guevara, Jungle Boy is nowhere to be seen. So he needs to bring new names in. Swerve so far has been great, but he needs to put other people up on that level. You know, Garcia's been a nice find. Hook is not quite ready yet, but he does need to be given this exposure. It's a necessity, but I think it's a good move. And I think this is the time of year to do it, because people are looking for things to change around this time of year. That's our natural inclination. You know, the calendar's changing. We're doing our New Year's resolutions, New Year, New Me, all that nonsense. It's a good time to put new people in front of the camera and see who shines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. The way you put it as a necessity, I think, is really a good way of putting it, and we'll see if that's able to stick. I mean, I think a lot of people are already ready for Swerve Strickland in the main event scene, and we'll see how quickly that is able to happen. So, again, WNIALivecast@gmail.com is where you can send your emails. Over to New Year's Dash, just real quick, a couple points that stood out to me. We have Riddle challenging Tanahashi. Already talked about that. Chase Owens challenging ELP and Hikuleo. Chase Owens is going to have Kenta at his side challenging the tag team there. Ospreay's last New Japan match, February 11th, in a cage versus Finley. Evil versus Tama Tonga, ? Is what I had written down.
Yeah.
And then they announced also Ospreay versus Okada at Battle in the Valley in San Jose for January 13th. So I'm not sure how tickets are selling for that show, but that should certainly pique a lot of fans' interest who might have been a little cool on that show in terms of whether or not they will attend. So any of those points there from New Year's Dash that you want to expand upon or anything else from that show that stood out to you?
So I won't say that I haven't looked at the price of flights from where I am here on the east coast of Canada to San Jose. Let's just say that it's not in the cards. I think that card is ridiculously stacked. Riddle, I believe, has a match as a tune-up. I don't remember who he's facing, though. Or it could be that Nick Nemeth has a match. One of those two has a match on the card. But Okada and Ospreay, at any time, on any card, is going to be incredible. Those two have amazing chemistry. They work so well together. It has to be seen. We've got, I think that the way they've set up these people coming in, the way that New Year's Dash just really set up an entire year's worth of stories. There's also a show going after El Desperado for the Junior Heavyweight Championship. There's going to be a lot to see here, and I would, if I had any way to go, I would go. Oh, yeah, it's going to be Riddle and
yeah.
a mystery partner against Zack Sabre Jr. and bad dude Tito. So TMDK, the former champion, is going to be there.
That is definitely a long flight from the east coast of Canada to San Jose. My goodness, how many stops would that take?
It'd probably be Toronto, and then I would imagine Chicago. I might be able to get a direct flight to San Jose from Toronto, but maybe L.A., I don't know. Oh, one thing we didn't mention, Shingo Takagi and Jon Moxley is also on this card. That's going to be physical.
Yes, so definitely looking forward to that. That's going to be a really good show if you're in the area and want to check it out. We got one more email question, but before we get to that, I want to talk about the big news of the week, which was The Rock coming back to Monday Night Raw, doing a segment with Jinder Mahal, and then finally referencing Roman Reigns and being the head of the table, and that was followed up as well on SmackDown. Not so many comments from Paul Heyman or Roman Reigns about it. They were pretty zipped up in terms of what they were going to say about it. I can't think of a less interesting way to start a Roman Reigns versus Rock feud than to have The Rock come out, do 15 minutes of shtick with Jinder Mahal, and then casually mention Roman Reigns in passing. Like, he got the huge pop, but, like, that's really the best idea you had. That's really it? That's how you're really going to kick this off? Like, I just thought that was as weak as you could possibly do. And maybe I'm spoiled because when WWE had announced the head of the table ceremony, where the Roman Reigns family members were going to come, and they were going to have this segment on Raw, and they were advertising it, and then I think Afa or Sika got sick, and they ended up just canceling it altogether. Like, the radar was going off in my head, like, oh, that's the perfect opportunity for The Rock to crash the party and, like, take issue with Reigns being the head of the table of the family. And so that was kind of how my mind had fantasy booked the kickoff to this feud. So from that to what we got on Monday, that's a pretty steep drop in my eyes. So what do you think about us apparently finally getting The Rock versus Roman Reigns? And keep in mind, you know, I'm somebody – as much as I'm criticizing it, I'm somebody who thinks The Rock versus Roman Reigns is a worthwhile match to have at WrestleMania. And I know that there are a lot of people who don't have any interest in seeing that match and would much rather see Roman Reigns against Cody or whomever. And so I'm saying this from the perspective of someone who is more than open to seeing that match. But seeing the way that it was kicked off on Monday was like, I seriously cannot think of a worse way that you could have started that feud.
This might be borderline sacrilegious. I'm a little over The Rock, to be honest. I find his shtick to be a little tired now.
That was not his best. That was not his best on Monday, for sure. It was not.
But it hasn't been his best the past four or five times he's come back. He just does the same lines over and over again. And, yeah, there is some degree of nostalgia and hitting his big lines that you want. But, yeah, Jinder Mahal is expendable. You can have him run down Jinder. That's no problem. But I feel sorry for Cody. I almost feel sorry for CM Punk because both of those guys are going to be pushed down and out of the way for this. There's a lot of belief that maybe if this match happens, it'll be in Australia for Elimination Chamber. And then we still get Cody and Reigns at WrestleMania. But that seems so backwards.
Do you see any possibility where they do Roman Reigns, The Rock one night, non-title, and then Roman Reigns, Cody the second night for the title? Is there any way you see Roman pulling double duty on that?
That's possible. There's been talk, and I've heard Wade say this, that nobody believes that Roman will wrestle twice on WrestleMania weekend. But if you do that, is there any way that The Rock and Reigns doesn't main event night one?
No.
So then CM Punk once again loses out on his ability to main event WrestleMania because a part-timer, the same part-timer who did it to him last time, comes in and takes the spot. And, you know, this is a guy who's volatile. I mean, maybe he's grown up a bit since then, but it's the same stuff. And then Cody doesn't get to say that he beat Roman at his best because Roman would have had a match the night before. Are you going to give Cody a match the night before? Maybe he defends his shot against somebody?
Yeah, I do wonder if you're Roman Reigns and you want him to stay heel after he loses the title, is that an excuse that he can use that, you know, his match with The Rock the night before sort of took it out of him and, you know, caused him to lose to Cody on night two?
I mean, if they want to, they could drag this out to 41. We have seen them do that before where, you know, Cena and The Rock was set up a year before it happened.
Yeah.
And
it's easy because The Rock's going to be on TV very rarely. So it's not like you have to fill a lot of TV time over that year span.
Yeah. You could do Rock solo if you wanted to at Mania before you got to Roman.
There are a lot of possibilities for sure, but I think hopefully this feud, whenever it does really kick into gear, brings something out of The Rock that we haven't seen in a while. I mean, you almost think it has to, right? I mean, he's been hitting the same notes of late. I agree with you on that. But this is going to give him a little something different to sink his teeth into, different topics, something different to talk about, and hopefully that brings out The Rock that we all remember on the mic.
Yeah. I think I don't have an issue with the match existing, but I think it's quite interesting that at a time when we have just said, you know, New Japan's bringing in new blood, AEW has to be giving people a chance to shine that are new to the spotlight, we have WWE bringing in people who have been out of the promotion to take main event spots from people who've been around all along. I mean, CM Punk falls into that group too. You've got the likes of LA Knight and Drew McIntyre being pushed out of their spots by these stars of yesteryear, for want of a better term, who are coming in and grabbing main event slots at WrestleMania. So
right.
It bugs me, and it shouldn't, you know? I think everybody wants to see Rock and Roman. That match should have happened a year ago.
Yeah. No, I agree. I thought that was the right time for it. But, you know, The Rock has to be in the right mood. He's got to be in the right frame of mind. He's got to be, you know, all of that stuff. You know, it's very hard when you have someone who has so many irons in the fire the way that The Rock does, and, you know, who wants to have enough prep time to be ready and to be in ring shape and all that jazz. It's really hard to nail down a date. And so if you're WWE, you take them whenever you can get them, I think is sort of their attitude for that. So I don't know. We'll see. It was the first night. Yeah.
I think more to the point, they're dealing with someone who can say no. He doesn't need this match. He doesn't need to WWE. If he doesn't want to do something, he will quite happily take his ball and go home. They're not used to that. Uh-huh. They don't have to deal with that right now. So if he's not happy, it ain't going to happen.
Yeah, and that's what it sounded like it was last year. I mean, he talked very openly on ESPN that the creative wasn't where he wanted it to be. And so, you know, if you're The Rock, you don't need that, right? You've got bigger fish to fry than that, so... we'll see if it comes together this year or if it's somewhere down the road or maybe a non-WrestleMania event. As you mentioned, Elimination Chamber is a possibility as well. Let's go back to the phones. We have DJ from Miami on the call. DJ, welcome back to Wrestling Night in America. What's your first question for us?
Yeah, I want to talk about Dolph Ziggler going into I don't know why. I really thought for sure he's going to get EAW. Nope, he went to Japan Wrestling. I just don't understand. He's so old, and I don't think he is ready for working this strong style, how old he is and how beat up he is. He's been hurt lately, and I just don't know him going into this is the right thing unless he's just going to do a U-turn and go right to EAW, but I don't understand. What do you guys think at the end of the day?
Yeah, he's 43 years old, and he's been off TV for much of the last few years. I mean, he has not been a featured player in WWE. Now, there was a 10-year run where he was having as many matches as anyone else on the WWE roster year in and year out. So certainly he's got wear and tear from that. But really, the last couple of years, Chris, he's not been nearly as active as he had been before. So do you have any concerns with Nick Nemeth in New Japan kind of adapting to that style?
Long term, yes. I would agree. Short term, so he's facing David Finlay, who of course speaks perfect English and wrestles a very North American style. I think Ziggler's strength has always been his selling and his ability to make things look like they hurt. And against Finlay, that's perfect. I would not want to see Nick Nemeth against, for example, Minoru Suzuki or Shingo Takagi or somebody like that, who is incredibly physical and needs that technical acumen as well. But I think in the short term, if he's coming in for a feud with Finlay, if maybe he does a few tag team matches with his brother, I think he'll be okay. And like you, DJ, I do expect him to go to AEW at some point.
All right, DJ, back to you for your second question.
Second thing is going into the EAW. I'm just confused. Like, we all knew it was going to be Adam Cole, but at the end of the day, Adam Cole's hurt. And I don't know if Wardlow and Joe really get to be friendly too much. I thought for sure with the lights going out, I don't know, do something crazy. Don't put a hat on a hat. I thought it was going to be Dolph Ziggler, somebody crazy. When you turn the lights off, it's just like bring somebody new. Just, you know, it's just the same over and over. But at the end of the day, I feel like MJF might be out for a few months compared to him trying to recover. You know, because this might do weird things, and I don't know, you know, how Tony is. So I'm scared that Wardlow might be a champion about time, MJF might come back or something crazy like that.
Well, I think Cole made the most sense, as unshocking as the reveal was, because I think a lot of people had predicted that Cole would be the guy, would be the devil. I think it kind of makes sense in the story they're telling. I had the same questions last week on the show about, look, if MJF is going to be out of commission for a while, and you're just revealing the faction whose sole purpose was to create strife for MJF, like, okay, what now? You know, what's their next move with MJF out of the picture? So that's my main concern with this group. I also didn't love the promo that Cole cut on Dynamite. I thought there was some good to it. I really thought, you know, them already teasing dissension with Wardlow, where Cole says that, you know, when Wardlow gets the title, he's going to hand it over to me. That's way too similar to Christian and Killswitch in the situation we just saw on the pay-per-view. That's too similar to too many storylines we've seen where, you know, we have a faction and one of the members has to, like, hand something over to someone else. Like, I just think that's been played out, and I think it's too early to sort of start teasing potential dissension for that. But, Chris, your thoughts overall on the Adam Cole reveal as the devil and that first promo we saw from him on Wednesday?
First thing, they need to find the room where the light controls are for every stadium they're in and put a very strong lock on it, because I am so over that gimmick. Adam Cole was the safe choice, and I think when you have a reputation for doing the shocking thing, sometimes going with the safe thing can be shocking because it isn't shocking, if you see what I mean. I was hoping for Britt Baker. I was really hoping for Britt Baker as the devil. I don't mind Adam Cole, but it's also not tremendously interesting. The promo, though, I was fine with it because it did set a mission statement of everybody going for gold right up until he said the bit about Wardlow handing over the title, and then Wardlow just sort of nodding as if to say, yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen. I don't think we needed that. And
no,
I guess they're trying to get to the point where it doesn't look like Tony Khan is trying to make Adam Cole into a manager for a monster, because somebody else tried to do that and it didn't work out so well for them. But yeah, they went with the safe pick, and honestly, I don't know what else they could have done that wouldn't have felt either weird or a complete letdown.
Yeah. Yeah, they were stuck with this one because it had dragged on too long. A lot of people were complaining about it, that the interest just wasn't there at the level of where it should have been for the TV time it was given and for the placement on the card being a main event storyline that it was featured as. So I think, you know, we got to a situation at the pay-per-view where people just wanted it over with. Like, I don't even think they cared so much who was going to be revealed. I think they just wanted the reveal so we could kind of move on to something else. And that's not, if you're a booker, that's not a position you want your creative to be in. And that's kind of where we were at World's End. So, DJ, we'll go back to you for your final question for us tonight.
Yep, my last question, and it is going to be a good one for, I guess, going off the rails for the new year. I want to talk about Chris Jericho and what's going on with that and how Tony really didn't defend him. He was looking stupid on it. And I don't know what's going to happen with that, but they should do something. But on the part of that, Velveteen Rabbit put out a statement saying he's sorry. At the same time, this is going on with Jericho. Coincidence? I have no idea. But at the end of the day, I don't know, guys. Well, Tony is like, you know, they said all these things, a handbook, all these things, but Tony did not defend him and didn't seem like it was more of a joke than anything. Like, he didn't really care. Like, he, you know, he was in sunglasses, a hat. He should have took him off and really talked about this because it's a serious situation.
So just to be clear, you mentioned Velveteen Dream. Not the Velveteen Rabbit, which is something completely different, but I digress. we know what you're talking about. The Jericho thing, it's going to be interesting to see how AEW handles this. Tony Khan was pressed on this topic at the World's End press conference, and he kind of demurred. He said there was never any investigation into Chris Jericho for some of the things that are out there. You know, it wasn't a good look for him to have the wig and the sunglasses on while he was addressing this. Just poor timing, I guess, and lack of realization that that's what you're wearing, maybe, for talking about a serious situation. Didn't make him come off very well. I'll grant him that. Excuse me. But, I think, Chris, what happens, I think he's going to be on Battle of the Belts next. So I think he's not even going to be on Dynamite this week or Collision or whatever the case may be. So I don't really know if there's a lot that Tony Khan can do at this point, because I don't think you can go back and do any kind of investigation or do any kind of, you know, suspend him for something that, you know, happened so long ago now. But yet the crowd is seemingly, and maybe it was just World's End, maybe it was a New York City crowd, maybe it was an aberration, but there's going to be a lot of people holding their breath the next time that Chris Jericho goes on TV, wondering if this is going to be the norm going forward if AEW doesn't take any measures to address this.
There is a lot to unpack here. Jericho is as close to bulletproof as you can get. We're talking about a guy whose wife was in the Capitol on January 6th a couple of years back, and people just seem to gloss over that when talking about Jericho. This guy is... I don't think you're on the mark. They're talking about Tony Khan can't go back and do an investigation. In a post-Me Too world, I think you not only can, he probably will have to if this turns into anything more than effectively a heart on a post on Twitter, which is what this all stems from, right, is Kaylee Ray putting a heart as a reply to a post.
My thing about going back and doing that is, how does that, and maybe he won't have any choice, but how does that make you look as a company that you never investigated this when it first happened? And now basically you're admitting, well, we didn't, we should have, and now we're going to, like, I think that's going to be the hard part is that admission that you're making by going back and doing some kind of investigation.
But I think it's a case of better late than never. It's also possible that they didn't know. And Kaylee Ray didn't say anything about this in public. This is the first time she's even surreptitiously commented on the whole situation of why she left AEW so abruptly. Jericho has had rumors about him in the past. There's never been anything concrete that came out about him on these in this sort of thing. You've also got to be really careful what you say about Chris Jericho, because it'll get back to him. He has ears everywhere. But the guy has Teflon, basically. I don't think he's going to be immune. If this turns into be something substantial and there was something there, I think it's an imperative to suspend him, no matter how long ago it was, or whether they brushed it under the rug to start with, because they can't now. It's out. He was getting booed at World's End, and that's not going to go away. In fact, it's only going to increase, because people will go, well, why are they booing him? They turn to Google, they see why. So something is going to have to be done to either say, look, we investigated this, and we found out that all it was a sleazy, inappropriate comment, but once he was told no, he left it alone. And that doesn't rise to the definition of harassment. It just makes him a scumbag, which isn't a suspendable offense, but it could quite easily put him on the heel side of things, whether AEW likes it or not. It's such a minefield to walk, because my credo is always to believe the victims. We don't know if there is a victim here, though.
Yeah.
You know, we're going by hearsay, third-party reports, you know, reading between the lines on not even a word on a social media site. There's a lot of jumping to conclusions being done here. If there is a victim and if there is any weight to these allegations, then something has to be done. But he's going to have to address it one way or another.
Yeah, and that's my concern is that – and just to be clear, it was Kylie Rae who made the likes and the – not Kaylee Rae. Kaylee Rae is in WWE as Elba Fire. So they sound very similar, but I just want to make that clarification. And my concern here is – nothing else comes out, or you know, there's no clarification to the situation, and so now you're just forever hanging in limbo. The crowds are continuing to boo, and you know, if you're AEW, as Tony Khan said, you know, he kind of waved it off in the post-show presser as kind of internet rumor mongering. Like, do you dare set the precedent of investigating now, years after the fact, based on likes on a social media post? Like, do you want to go down that road? So I think the worst thing that can happen is there's no clarification on this, and everybody's just kind of in limbo, and it puts everybody in a real awkward situation. But as you said, you know, believe the victims. If they're not comfortable coming forward, they're not comfortable coming forward, and that's something that everybody has to deal with. And there's no fault in that. So DJ, thank you for taking us off the rails as you did there. Appreciate hearing from you, and looking forward to hearing from you again soon.
I do, Sam. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, DJ. And Chris, to wrap things up today, our final email question, this is from John. He says, hi, Greg and Chris. Happy New Year to both of you and everyone who you love and the PW Torch listeners and readers. He's got two topics today. The first is how to navigate the Rock, Roman, Cody situation without sacrificing Cody. John says, after the Rock's return on Raw and his head of the table comment, it seems he's back for at least one match, if not two or maybe three. I have four different paths to make this triumvirate work. Number one, you do the Rock-Roman match at Elimination Chamber in head-of-the-table match, and Roman wins, and that's the end of the story. The first path is simply a match, and based on the idea that the Rock may not have space in his schedule for WrestleMania, he puts Roman over for the title of head-of-the-table, and Roman can forever brag about dethroning the Rock and sending him back to Hollywood. This also opens up a possible revisiting of Rock-Roman later. Number two, Rock beats Roman in a non-title head-of-the-table match at Elimination Chamber, and Roman demands a rematch for the title at WrestleMania Night 1. However, Cody gets Roman Night 2. Roman is so furious he lost to The Rock in the role of head-of-the-table that he obsessively challenges Rock to a rematch at WrestleMania and puts his championship on the line. However, Cody, having won the Elimination Chamber to earn his shot, gets his title match on the second night against the winner. Roman gets his win back against The Rock and is looking strong heading into defending his title against Cody, who ends up defeating the guy who demolished The Rock at WrestleMania Night 1 and finishes his story. To make it fair, Cody can also have two matches over both nights, perhaps teaming with Jay to take on Jimmy and Solo on Night 1. You get Rock back-to-back PLEs, give Roman the monumental victory over his legendary cousin, and have Cody dethrone Roman at arguably his strongest for the championship. Number three, Rock enters the Royal Rumble match and gets screwed by Roman and viciously beat down by the Bloodline. He wants revenge, and Roman keeps ducking him until WrestleMania night one in a non-title match for the title or head of the table. Cody wins the Rumble and gets night two and defeats Roman. You can still have Rock at Elimination Chamber if his schedule allows and have him defeat someone relatively credible who can afford the loss to help him get into ring shape, perhaps in AJ Styles. But instead of doing the Rock-Roman match at Elimination Chamber, you do it at WrestleMania Night 1. However, Rock gets no victory over Roman in this scenario, but Cody still gets his shining moment at the Rumble and Mania. Number four, Cody Rock versus Roman Solo at Elimination Chamber, Rock Roman and Cody Roman at WrestleMania over two nights. Cody, the Royal Rumble winner, gets to rub elbows with The Rock. You don't need to risk Rock getting injured and can protect him, and Rock could get the pin on Roman in the tag match after Cody first hits the crossroads and earn a title match against Roman on night one, which he loses. You protect Roman by having him take both Cody and Rock's finishers, and you give Rock his victory over Roman to earn a singles match and still give Cody his moment. Cody defeats Roman on night two for the championship. Question, what are your thoughts on these scenarios, and which one do you think is most likely, which is least likely, and which would you personally do? So I would say any scenario that has Rock wrestling two matches is probably out. I just don't see him taking that risk from a movie filming standpoint. We know that the last time he wrestled against John Cena, he got injured to the point that filming had to be delayed on one of his movies. I just think there's too much risk in doing multiple matches. I also think I don't think you waste Rock's match, and I say waste, maybe that's the wrong word, but I don't think you use the Rock's one match at Elimination Chamber. I know that that's now a big show. It's in Australia. It's a stadium show. So in that regard, it's on par with WrestleMania. But look, WrestleMania is WrestleMania. If I'm The Rock and I'm wanting to come back for one match, it's going to be WrestleMania. Like there's no – and The Rock versus Roman is a WrestleMania-level match. Say what you will about it. You cannot like the idea of that match. But I think to most fans, it's a WrestleMania-level matchup. So when you eliminate those two, I think it's the first scenario is closest – because it has doing the Rock Roman match, one match, Roman wins at the end of the story. But John has an Elimination Chamber. I would just say at WrestleMania. So, you know, I think that's to me my qualifiers. One, it's at WrestleMania, not the Chamber. And two, it's one match and that's it.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on the first scenario being the most likely. If there is a second match, I can see a tag match at Elimination Chamber as the second match because it allows The Rock to do less. Mm-hmm. I don't want Rock Roman at Mania. I don't want it. I want Rock and Cody as the only Roman and Cody as the only Roman match at Mania, and it needs to be the main event of night two. I'm not even the world's biggest Cody fan, but if you take us on this ride for a year and then we don't get the payoff in a one-on-one match with both men at their strongest, what is it all for?
Mm-hmm.
You've just completely undone all of your storytelling for a year and a half.
Yeah.
So, you know, just give us what we need and find another way to do the Rock-Roman thing.
Yeah, I hear you. And the one scenario that John didn't bring up that you had brought up earlier is maybe it doesn't even happen this year. Maybe they start teasing it for 2025. I mean, I think it might be hard for The Rock to commit to that date because he doesn't know his movie schedule, but it actually might be easier to commit to that date because he may not have any filming commitments for that yet, and he can just kind of carve out that time this far ahead of time. So, you know, that's something to think about too. And the second part of John's email is women's Royal Rumble potential winners. John says, "This will be a little quicker, but for the record, I'd have Bayley win and face Io Sky at WrestleMania and win with a Bayley to belly to have her moment at WrestleMania and cement her as a babyface again. Some other options, John lists Becky Lynch, build to a match with Rhea Ripley at WrestleMania, with which Rhea wins. Bianca Belair, have Bianca win and challenge Rhea, given that they teased this as a match after last year's WrestleMania before both went to separate brands. Bayley, as mentioned, despite tension between her and Damage Control seemingly vanishing, have Bayley win the Rumble and have her take her time deciding between Rio and Io, and resume her tension between her and Damage Control. You can use this time to naturally transition Bayley into a babyface and tell a compelling story. Jade Cargill, give her a huge win off the bat and have her challenge either Rhea or Io at WrestleMania. Nia Jax, have her challenge Rhea at WrestleMania, especially if WWE plans to transition Rio into a babyface. Sasha Banks, outside bet, but if WWE feels the need to meet her demands, primarily because of the Charlotte injury, they can keep this under wraps and have her win the Rumble and challenge either Io or Rhea at WrestleMania. Question. If you had to make a prediction right now, who do you think is most and least likely to win, and who would you go with personally? Keep up the great work. Now, you know, before John's email, I hadn't really thought of Bayley winning and facing Io, but that may be the most intriguing to me. I think having Bianca win, Bianca and Rhea is sort of my dream match at this point. I don't think Bianca is anywhere near as hot as she should be to face Rhea, and maybe a Rumble win gives her that opportunity to get heated back up. But, yeah, maybe Becky. You know, you can't rule her out. She's obviously the biggest star of the division, especially now that Charlotte's out of the picture. So, to me, Becky, Bayley, and, you know, I don't think Jade is ready yet. I think maybe she makes an appearance in the Rumble, but I don't think they'd have her win it already. I don't think Sasha Banks ends up in AEW, in WWE, so I kind of cross her off the list. I mean, Bianca, Becky, and Bayley, is there anyone else that you see having a realistic shot at winning the Women's Rumble this year?
Bianca, Becky, and Bayley. No, I don't think there's any realistic options based on the storytelling we've seen in recent months. I can't even see someone like a Shayna Baszler taking a step up, much to my chagrin. I think that's one of the biggest missed opportunities in recent memory. You know, it's funny. I was thinking, as you were, I had never considered Bayley winning it, but I believe she's the only one of the four horsemen that are still employed who hasn't won it. Charlotte's won it. Becky's won it. Bayley hasn't. And I don't think Bianca wins it 2 years in a row. I don't think Becky needs to win it, especially just having lost to Nia Jax. You can heat up Becky at will. I think Bayley is an excellent choice, and I think there's an opportunity to do a beatdown angle where she is forcibly evicted from Damage Control and then comes back, wins the Rumble, and challenges Io Sky, and we get face Bayley again. So that's an excellent shout.
And that's what I was going to say, too. You know, Bianca winning, I'll never argue against, because I think she should be the biggest star in the division. But like you said, she won it last year. I agree with you, I do find it hard to believe they'll go to that well twice in a row. And really, like, the story is much more interesting for Bayley than it would be for Bianca, given where they are right now. And things could change over the next few weeks for sure. But given where things stand right now, I would say Bayley winning is probably the most interesting direction of those that we'd consider, unless it's just a complete off-the-wall someone who wins. But I doubt that's going to happen. Chris, thank you so much for joining me here tonight. It was a pleasure getting to talk to you at length here about New Japan and everything else. So before we go, I'll let you plug your social media and what you do for The Torch.
Yeah, so I cover New Japan and New Japan Strong events for The Torch. Always happy to jump on and talk to anyone about New Japan or just wrestling in general, actually. You can find me on Twitter. I suppose we're supposed to call it X, but that hurts me in my soul, at LansDelicious, LansDelicious. And that's tagged at the bottom of all of my posts on PW Torch. My reports on New Year Dash and Wrestle Kingdom are up right now. And more than likely, you'll see my report for Battle in the Valley sometime over the weekend. So thanks for having me, Greg. This has been a blast. I've been inducted into Wrestling Night in America with DJ and Ryan. So I feel like I've got the full experience here tonight.
You absolutely did. There's no doubt about that. Thanks, Chris. Pleasure talking to you tonight.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yep. And thank you all for listening. Great to be back here taking phone calls and emails. I know we had a couple of weeks where we weren't able to do so, but it's great to hear from everybody again and take some phone calls. And remember, if you want to join in on the conversation, 515-605-9345. We'll be back here next Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, because if it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America.